Now we're ready for session 3, where we'll be dealing with barriers to gratitude. We must remember that though gratitude is a very good idea, believing in it is only like a blinker that points us in the right direction. We're ready now to explore what sends us on a detour. What gets us off track? And this is not a simple matter. It's not about just forgetting to say grace before meals. The ways that we get sidetracked are much more subtle and complex than that. Some time ago, I attended a workshop on gratitude, and the presentation was thoughtful and inspiring, and everyone I was with left believing that a thankful heart is a glorious goal, that appreciation is a climate of the soul in which our spirits thrive. But then, when we got in the car, in a matter of moments, life began to intrude. On the way home, the conversation slowly deteriorated into exasperation at the stalled traffic, nitpicking about the food that was served at the workshop, thoughts of an upcoming Sunday jammed with too many demands, chronic fatigue, the sorry state of the world. You get the idea. This illustrates the fact that though our brains buy into a concept, our minds and bodies are often stubbornly resistant. Like rubber bands, we bounce back to business as usual, often in our same surly selves. So how do we unknowingly aid and abet this process? What are the patterns of thought that sabotage us? One of the first things we need to look at is what I'm calling discounted thinking. This is revealed by statements like, "Oh, it was really nothing." Perhaps someone is thanking us profusely for a favor done, and we promptly devalue their gift of gratitude. Without intending to do it, we throw cold water on their spontaneous expression of thanks. This attitude of diminishing another person's judgment shows itself in countless subtle ways, a lot of times even in response to a compliment. Someone can say to us something as simple as, "Oh, what a lovely red dress," and we are likely to have a discounting response, like, "This old thing, I've had it for years, I got it on sale." Many of us grew up with the idea that to acknowledge gratitude openly, with a heartfelt thank you, with no diminishment, might indicate a hidden boastfulness on our part. Instead, I believe it affirms the recipient's thoughtfulness. Another example of discounted thinking is, "Everything's just great." Now, this is a tricky one, because on the surface, it appears to be an outgrowth of positive thinking. How can that be a bad thing, right? Sometimes, fake it till you make it behavior coaxes your mind to fall in line with your words, but at other times, it acts as a cover-up for unexpressed feelings. We might think of Thanksgiving as a kind of continuum, with whiners on one end and over-the-top gushers on the other. The whiners thrive on a chaotic existence where nothing is ever okay. And the gushers are so determined to be positive that they lose touch with their own authenticity. On the one hand, every thankful thought is followed by a discounting, "Yes, but," and on the other end, the discounting comes in the form of a plastic smile. So the task is, how does one strike this delicate balance between honesty and hope? Perhaps part of the balance we're seeking involves sitting with our feelings and not on them. We can acknowledge difficulty without choosing to live in its icy grip, without feeding the growing moroseness so that it becomes a part of our identity. Another way we discount gratitude is by saying things like, "This can't last." "Yes, of course I'm thankful," we say, "but when is the other shoe going to drop?" This familiar discounted thinking assumes that the present fortune is a fluke, the calm before the inevitable storm of misfortune. After all, isn't that how life is, we think? We feel more prudent, and somehow smarter, to hedge our bets, steeling ourselves for the disappointment that is surely lurking behind the next corner. So we willingly move the negative energy ahead in anticipating of the joy falling apart so that we won't be caught off guard. But in doing so, we make it virtually impossible to be present to the wonder of the moment. And in some insidious way, we project a somber, fearful reality that we actually live into. Another form of discounted thinking I'm calling comparative thinking. We say things like, but look at their house. Look at the way they're living. Though this hidden preoccupation with keeping up with the Joneses is denied by every single one of us, it still may be causing us to diminish the blessings in our own lives because we're constantly comparing. It creeps in by the back door of our psyches, revealed in such statements like, we're just going to a fishing cabin on our family vacation, not to Disney World. Or, I don't know why they would want that much yard to mow anyway. We even compare our spiritual lives to others with the inference that they have it better or easier than we do. We say things or think things like, if I didn't have all this pressure, I could be a better person. Or if I didn't work in this toxic atmosphere, I could certainly be more loving. Or it must be nice to have the time and money to attend all those spiritual retreats. Or no wonder he's praising God, he's healthy and wealthy. We let ourselves off the spiritual hook by making endless excuses for remaining stuck in our negative patterns. If all else fails, we can always justify our gloom with, but just look at the way I was brought up. Regardless of the details of a troubled past, we're unable to access an ounce of gratitude because we have become hopelessly mired in a victim role. I heard someone say recently that the statute of limitations on most of our childhood traumas has just about run out. Now, I'm not disputing that many of us have been damaged and hurt by life and are currently dealing with monumental changes. It's possible that we can look those problems squarely in the face and persist until we find a trickle of gratitude hidden in the horror of it. Moving toward a thankful heart involves active response ability, that is, response-ability. Consciously choosing to respond rather than react. Another form of comparative thinking is when we so easily say, well, it could be worse. Somehow we feel more deserving of blessing if we acknowledge that we could be in a more desperate scenario than the one we're in. We say things like, I'd better be grateful for this miserable head cold because after all, it could have been pneumonia. We even point to the maladies and misfortunes of others in an attempt to alleviate our own. No malice intended, it's just comparative thinking. And once again, our gratitude is made toxic by subtle guilt. Another thing we say is, it could be better than this. This variety of comparative thinking focuses on what isn't rather than what is. The proverbial cup that is half empty instead of half full. Vacation is coming up, but then it's going to be back to the same old grindstone. Yes, our pastor is nurturing to the congregation, but I don't like the preaching. Or at this point in my life, I have more options, but I don't have any energy to do anything. Over and over and over again. We prick our own full balloon of appreciation, letting the positive air escape because we didn't get the perfection we projected. Our next category of thinking is guilty thinking. And though I've already mentioned the problem of guilt-based gratitude, this deserves a category all its own because it sneaks up on us wearing many discreet disguises. We say things like, I know I should be more grateful. No one has ever been made to feel grateful by being told that they ought to be. What might have been spontaneous appreciation then becomes dogged duty, gratitude through gritted teeth. We pretend to be grateful simply because we should be. After all, we have so much. Since a thankful attitude is more socially revered, we force ourselves into proper behavior and gratitude becomes some sort of ego-fueled performance. In this category of guilty thinking, we also say things like, God spared me, God protected me. And there's survivor's guilt again. Though I understand the human gut reaction that this statement represents, the theology of it has always bothered me. Because there's an unspoken implication that God is pulling the strings in choosing some folks for pain and death and others for survival. And this seems somehow out of sync with the nature of God as revealed in Scripture and in life experience. It seems natural to feel the keenness of life's purposes when one has experienced a narrow escape. But the leap from that awareness to God's intervention is a gigantic one. In her provocative newsletter titled Connections, Barbara Wendland puzzled over the problem of identifying God as the cause of everything. Here's what she said. The picture of God choosing all that happens also becomes unbelievable when two people are in the same car wreck and one survives and the other is killed. We may try to justify the apparent capriciousness of such outcomes by claiming that God still had something important for the surviving person to do. But what does this say about the value of the one who died? Do I have a better answer for why and how these things happen? No, I don't. However, I'm more comfortable with living with the mystery of the question than in settling for inadequate answers just so I can feel intellectually satisfied. Can we not be content with just saying, "Thank you, God"? Then we can affirm our own genuine response of thanksgiving without filling in the blanks with faulty logic. Another form of guilty thinking is represented by statements like, I must be thankful for my suffering. This stumbling block to a thankful heart gets all mixed up with the rigid scriptural interpretation of such passages as, quote, we also boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, endurance produces character, and character produces hope. From Romans 5:3, and things like, give thanks in all circumstances, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you, from 1 Thessalonians 5. Many Protestants have been told that suffering will guarantee stars in their crowns, while some Roman Catholics are often encouraged by the suggestion that it will shorten their stay in purgatory. We can't deny that there's enormous growth potential in suffering, because the fruits are often endurance and character. However, there's a critical difference here, as far as I'm concerned. I think we are called to be grateful in all circumstances, but not necessarily for all circumstances. The passages about suffering need to be seen in light of Romans 8:28. All things work together for good for those who love God. Notice it asserts that all things work together for good. Not all things are good. I recently reviewed a book entitled When Prayers Aren't Answered by John E. Welshans. And that book has been very useful to me in dealing with this whole idea of unanswered prayer and the role of tragedy in our lives. I like the analogy given by Flora Woolner during one of her instruction periods at the Academy for Spiritual Formation. And my paraphrase of what she said that day goes like this. It's one thing to say that if my child falls down the concrete stairs and breaks his leg, I, as a good parent, will do everything in my power to bring something good out of that experience. I'll read to him, teach him that he shouldn't have left his rollerblades at the top of the stairs, help him heal, love him through the experience of pain and recovery. However, it's quite another thing to say that as a good parent, I would push that child down the stairs in order that he learn those valuable lessons. Another form of guilty thinking is revealed by our statements such as this: why am I so blessed? I'll admit to you that sometimes when I'm lying snug and warm, covered by a down comforter on a cold night, I can't help wondering, how did I happen to be here in this warm bed instead of shivering in some windy refugee tent? Certainly, this is a common conundrum to those of us who are privileged to have a roof over our heads and full stomachs. It may not carry the clear label of guilt, but dwelling on it can be a barrier to gratitude nonetheless. One day, one of my spiritual direction clients spoke of one of her current projects, and it reminded me of the times that we can get mired in this feeling of blessedness so that it blocks us from gratitude. Mildred spoke of one of her current projects, that of redoing the living room in her spacious two-story home. She and her husband had reared their children in abundant comfort in a house that they loved, but the room was ready for a facelift. When we were talking, she introduced a concern that, though she was afraid it was trivial, hinted at a deeper tension that confronts all of serious seekers. The internal dilemma was something like this. She wondered, how could she spend hundreds of dollars putting frills on her elegant existence when some folks didn't have a home at all? How could she delight in the colorful fabrics and the rich textures that made her happy to come into the room when there were people who didn't have that same opportunity? Now, the short answer to that question is, I just don't know. But in thinking about it, I wonder if perhaps this is a dilemma that's not meant to be resolved. Perhaps this is a paradox that rightfully should present a dilemma for us. Somehow it seems appropriate and true and real to live with some measure of this anxiety, always searching for ways to affirm both realities, the reality of one's abundance and the reality of the world's need. Our next category is ego-centered thinking. Now, these thought barriers pull grateful energy back into the dark hole of our own self-centeredness. We begin to interpret events within the context of how they affect us. It must be something I did. It must be something I said. One of the ways that we express this is in saying things like, why did this happen to me? Underneath this natural response lie other questions, such as, what did I do to deserve this? Why did God do this to me? Or what is God trying to teach me? All too often, our knee-jerk reaction is an assumption that negative events are the acts of an angry and punishing God. Then the paranoia of guilt takes over because it's all about us. The feelings are ours and we can own them, but the situation may be more about who someone else is than what we did. I've noticed another version of this why is this happening syndrome by observing the resistant behavior of an elderly person whom I'll call Cynthia. She seems to have some refusal to accept the limitations of the aging process, and it keeps her in a constant state of upheaval. Recently, she phoned me in high anxiety, absolutely indignant, because her 80-year-old friend was experiencing a heart abnormality. Rather than being grateful that there was excellent medication available for this condition, she kept saying, "Well, I just don't understand it. I can't believe this is happening. It isn't fair. She's just doing too much. She ought to take better care of herself." And Cynthia's inference, not only in regard to her friend's health, but also to her own occasional aches and pains, was that it should not be happening. There's an undercurrent of entitlement here, as if an exception to the natural aging process that comes to all of us needed to be made in her case or in the case of her friends. Gratitude can flourish in an atmosphere of acceptance, and in this instance, acceptance of aging as not a disease to be cured, but as a meaningful part of life. Another way that we expose our own ego-centered thinking is when we make statements that begin with, "After all I've been through." There's a great value in being able to express one's grief and hardship out loud, particularly within a circle of like-minded and sympathetic companions. That's the nature of countless support groups that help people daily as they cope with wounded lives. However, those who spend excessive time and energy working through the loss, trying to make sense of the death, and being preoccupied by it for extended periods of time can get mired in their own distress. Continued focus on the problem can increase its ferocity, and a toxic atmosphere referred to by teacher Caroline Mace as woundology can sometimes result. Now, this kind of perverse one-upmanship, where conversation becomes a matter of "my story is more grim than your story," produces an ego investment in shock value and in staying stuck. Once again, it's a matter of allowing the healing process to be fluid rather than stagnant. Another version of ego-centered thinking is exposed by some of our statements like, "I have so much to do." Appreciation takes time and focus and an ability to live in the moment. We're becoming immune to the power of cliches like "stop and smell the roses" or "there's more time to more to life than increasing its speed," while we continue our addictions to multitasking and busyness. Christina Baldwin describes it this way: "Speed is some guy running through the airport shouting on a cell phone. Pace is going around the block with a 3-year-old and noticing everything the child is noticing. When we move at the pace of guidance, it occurs to us to wonder what plans God might have for us in the midst of the plans we have for ourselves. When we are moving along at great speed in a fantasy of control, even a traffic delay can be interpreted as a personal affront rather than a neutral event." Close quote. The truth is, we sometimes have a perverse ego investment in being busy. After all, whose mouth said yes to all these commitments? As we attempt to thrive on chaos, the chaos of our own busyness, we lose our grip on gratitude. We also say things like, "What's in it for me?" Now, one might think that expressions of thanksgiving are free from ego contamination. Dream on. I sometimes laugh out loud at the never-ending capacity that we have to see things in terms of their effect on us, even deceiving ourselves about the purity of our good traits. Now, I don't mean to make these comments as an exercise in self-judgment, but rather to open us to deeper self-awareness. Sometimes it helps to accept our own humanity with an inward chuckle. Consider our subtle attachments to the outcome of our thankful behavior. If we are thankful and positive, people are more likely to seek our company. Well, they will. Studies show that we'll be healthier and happier. Yes, they do. We may even live longer. Well, we might. Our relationships will improve. They probably will. Some even link thankful behavior to a hope of heaven and celestial reward. We just need to remember that genuine thanksgiving is not tied to outcome. We often reveal again our ego investment, our ego-centered thinking, by saying things like, "This is not the life I anticipated." There's a chilling quote that opens Ann Tyler's novel Back When We Were Grown-Ups, and it's this: "Once upon a time, there was a woman who discovered that she had turned into the wrong person," close quote. Now, who among us, especially in midlife, has not had some moment of truth in realizing that our life has not turned out as we expected? Maybe worse, maybe better, but certainly different. We've made mistakes, we had failed relationships, we made poor business decisions. On the other hand, we probably had surprising successes or ended up in strange places or experienced more diversity and excitement than we dreamed of. At some point, however, there is a creative poignancy in accepting that we may never see Bora Bora or we may never write the great American novel. As we release the life agenda that we grasp so rigidly, we can begin to relish the delights of today with fresh eyes, with thankful spirits. When life fails to conform to our projections, we often seal ourselves off from God's surprises. We simply don't see them. Acceptance and appreciation expand the lens of life, keeping us open to unexpected invitations and unmapped detours. Now let's look for a moment at a category that I'll call external thinking, because external thinking can also distract us and put us on mental detours away from gratitude. Now, the power of outside forces to form our norms for gratitude is as close as the dial on your television set or a ticket to the movies or a click on the internet. It's as if the speed of today's technology is constantly outdistancing our ability to reflect responsibly on its effects. Think about the times we begin our sentences with, "on the evening news." I have an elderly friend who, because of age and illness, is largely confined to her home. And over the past few years, I've watched the growing influence of her constant companion, the TV set. Sitcom characters have become her family. Network news form the reality in which she lives. Consequently, she's become more fearful and despairing of the condition of the world. The steady drip, drip, drip of sensationalism and crime occupies her thoughts and creates a disproportionate sense of evil in the world. We become accustomed to man's inhumanity to man, and we become unwitting citizens of a culture of fear. As one person is shot, which is too many, of course, we tend to forget the millions who were not harmed. If one child is kidnapped, we forget the millions who were snug in their beds. Barbara Brown Taylor wrote about this dilemma in a recent issue of Christian Century. She said this, quote, "I do not watch television because the world on the screen is not the world I want to live in. Bursts of gratuitous kindness are the mustard seeds from which healing bushes sometimes grow. They constitute the alternate reality that I want to live in, even if it means limiting my exposure to other kinds of news." Close quote. Another vehicle of external thinking and influence is, of course, the world of the movies, the cinema. I went in a neighborhood theater recently to have a peaceful afternoon cinema treat, chomping popcorn and enjoying this provocative foreign film that I'd read about. But before I could sink down in my seat, I was jolted by the pandemonium of the previews. My ears were assaulted by crashes, screams, explosions, and in 5 minutes, My frayed nerves were clinging to their last thread. We know instinctively that repeated violence breeds insensitivity and skewers our view of human nature. We become guarded, assuming that others are out to get us. I think, unfortunately, we have become more jaded, blasé, and immune to the suffering of others, as we have become so influenced by movie and television. As Annie Dillard so wisely put it, quote, "How we spend our days is how we spend our lives," unquote. Another influence is, of course, in the celebrity world. Our norms are being affected by this fascination that we seem to have. And that fascination is costing us plenty, as entertainment stars and sports figures are paid unthinkable sums of money, which of course gives impressionable young people a distorted sense of the traditional values espoused by most of their parents. But while we tend to project the blame on the media for shaping our needs and norms and skewing our feeling about gratitude, part of the responsibility rests on our shoulders. We have the hand that turns these machines off and on. In a recent poll, there were more young people who wanted to be famous than wanted to have a meaningful career. More knew the identity of a film star's new boyfriend than the identity of the local senator. The old adage goes, we are what we eat, and maybe it's also true that we become what we watch. Now I want us to look for a moment at depressive thinking, which wears several guises. Sometimes we make statements or we think thoughts such as this: what difference can I possibly make? It's just a drop in the bucket. A sort of doomsday thinking. And in the face of overwhelming violence and poverty at home and abroad, we can easily succumb to these feelings of powerlessness. In fact, it sometimes feels callous to us to even reach for a thankful thought, as if we were turning our backs on the world's pain. However, wisdom traditions through the centuries urge us to believe in the power of one act of kindness, one compassionate thought. Especially when one person's commitment combines with others to make a difference in the world. The biblical tradition contains many parables and metaphors that express the unseen reality that a tiny mustard seed, the actions of one person, somehow grows into a huge plant where birds build their nests. We think of the leaven in the loaf of bread that challenges everything, and the feeding of the multitudes with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Another feeling that is common to any of us that have lived long enough is the feeling that the darkness is overwhelming us. We all have experiences of this. I remember one of mine. I was lying on the sofa in my old plaid bathrobe, the afghan pulled tightly around me, feeling as if I were at the bottom of a dark well. In fact, it felt like I was the dark well, past the pain of mere weeping. Tears couldn't begin to represent or release what I was feeling. Mercifully, nature seemed to be providing a protective numbness, an emotional anesthetic to allow me to breathe. Yet there was a tiny blue flame that flickered faintly in the darkness inside me. Its fragile light felt tentative, like a dying pilot light in a gas oven. I heard myself saying to those around me, "But when will I feel like a real person again? When will I feel better?" The familiar voice of a dear friend, who was also divorced, pierced the silence with these words, "Oh, Linda, about 2 years, I guess." I'll admit, I wanted to slap her. For a couple of months after my husband left, I had switched to survivor mode, committed to remaining strong for my 2 sons. But I was really ill-prepared to do it. I'd never really experienced that kind of rejection. The kind that seemed to erase my personhood in its wake. My daily mantra of strength, "You can do this," was growing less convincing by the day. And on this particular evening, that fragile facade had finally cracked. I can't remember who called whom, but I found myself, thank goodness, surrounded by a circle of caring friends. At the time, I couldn't have cared less. I was so far down that black hole that even their love couldn't reach me. But then, maybe it did. Fortunately for me, their bond of friendship was prepared to go the distance with me, until I could climb up the sides of that black pit by my fingernails. I've never been very patient with darkness, mine or anyone else's, because, as I've mentioned before, "Look for the Silver Lining" was my theme song, and it was a mantra that had led me skipping and smiling through life and unwilling to tolerate gloom. Though I was unable to see it at the time, that gloomy cocoon that I was in contained the tiny seeds of deeper growth for me. And such is the nature of the transition sometimes referred to as the dark night of the soul. Dr. Gerald May's book, by that title, talks about the creative potential of these seemingly desperate passages. And I quote, "Each experience of the dark night gives its gifts, leaving us freer than we were before, more available, more responsive, more grateful. Freedom and gratitude are abiding characteristics of the dark night, but they don't arrive until the darkness passes. They come with the dawn." Though we may not be able to be grateful for all these dark nights, through grace we can be grateful in them, acknowledging them as rich soil for growing our souls. As we can see, our journey to a thankful heart is littered with the boulders and barricades of our own confused thinking, discounted thinking, comparative thinking, guilty thinking, egocentric thinking, external and depressive thinking. Rather than hastily brushing the barriers aside, we must be with them with awareness, compassion, and forgiveness. Then that loving process makes us ready to cross the bridges to a deeper appreciation of life. And that will be the topic of our next broadcast.